reality is that the people who call themselves capitalists don't believe in capitalism. They believe in corporate socialism. The $700 billion is equal to about 60% of all the income taxes that people will pay this year. That's an implied 50% tax increase.
That's journalist David K. Johnston, and this is Writer's Voice. Welcome to the show. I'm Michael Pollitt, in for Francesca Rhiannon. The meltdown on Wall Street has many people asking, how come the government can find hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out the guys who brought us this mess, but always claims there's no money to save homeowners from foreclosure, provide health insurance to those who can't afford it, or clean up the environment? Well, today's guest says it's all part of an endemic pattern of corporate welfare, where government policy is rigged to benefit the richest Americans at the expense of the rest of us. David K. Johnston's latest book is Free Lunch. Johnston was an investigative journalist for the New York Times before becoming an independent reporter. He won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. Francesca started out by asking Johnston about his take on the current crisis on Wall Street.
You've talked about seizing the commonwealth to promote the narrow wealth, and that's a term you use in your book, Free Lunch.
That's right.
Now, what do you think of this proposed $750 billion bailout?
This, Francesca, is not about taking care of Main Street. It isn't going to help little borrowers. It's not going to help two-bit landlords who got put into bad products. And by the way, unpublished data at the Fed, which was shared with me by somebody there, shows that 20%, one in five subprime loans, the borrower qualified for a prime loan. This is not a bailout of the people who have bad loans, and it is not going to help your neighborhood, if there are a lot of bad loans in your neighborhood, from houses being abandoned. This is a bailout of Wall Street. They want $700 billion, at least to start, of your and my money, and how it's spent will be unreviewable. That's not a democracy. That is not an open and free government.
What's the danger of that to us, specifically in terms of solving this economic crisis?
Well, first of all, there is a market mechanism for this, which is failure, and the price of it may be awful, and I concede that it could well lead to a general depression if we simply let the market work its way out. But if you really believe in market capitalism, that's what, of course, should happen. The reality is that the people who call themselves capitalists don't believe in capitalism. They believe in corporate socialism. The $700 billion is equal to about 60% of all the income taxes that people will pay this year. It's certainly more than half. That's an implied 50% tax increase, because you're going to have to pay for that money. And you're going to pay for it not by having your taxes go up 50%, but by the government borrowing more money. They're going to raise the debt ceiling now to over $11 trillion. And that debt crowds out money for everything else. We won't have money for fixing the infrastructure, for providing health care to poor children, for financing research, which is crucial, fundamental research to long-term economic growth. We're crowding out all this stuff. You know, only about 11% of medical research grants are being approved now by the National Institutes of Health. We're not investing in the future. We're selling our future so that the super rich can have better lives today, so that those who own one jet can have two, and those who own two can get a third one so the kids have one.
We've been talking about the financial meltdown, but there's another story in your book that you follow which also has some topical relevance for us today. I was just in New York this past weekend. It was the last day at the old Yankee Stadium.
Yes.
And the new one is being built right next to it. You kind of follow the history of this, how the stadium industry profits from taxpayers, and you take up precisely this new Yankee Stadium.
Yep.
Walk us through this. Tell us how this is an example of the kind of corporate socialism you write about in your book, Free Lunch.
Well, let me start with the headline, Francesca. The big four commercial sports, baseball, basketball, football, and hockey, derive all of their profits, from hidden subsidies from the taxpayers. they do not earn their profits in the marketplace. In the case of Yankee Stadium, George Steinbrenner wanted a new stadium, and he wanted to originally try to get it built in downtown Manhattan, which would be an abominable misuse of valuable real estate. Mayor Rudy Giuliani allowed the Yankees and the Mets to use taxpayer money to lobby for subsidies for themselves. They then arranged, effectively in the dead of night, over 8 days with no public notice, with the cooperation of the borough of the Bronx, the city of New York, the state in Albany, and the federal government in Washington, to take away parkland from people in the poorest congressional district in America. And by the way, the poorest congressional district in America, the South Bronx, is right next door to the richest congressional district in America on the Upper East Side of New York. A couple of federal bureaucrats questioned what was happening here and said, well, wait a minute, what's the public say about taking away their parkland for a private use? And they were told there were no public protests. Well, of course there weren't. The public had no idea. And it turns out when the Yankees started to build this stadium, they said, well, there's no subsidy. And I got them to admit that was a lie. Then the subsidy was 200 and some million, and then 300 and 400. It's now well over $800 million, and I'm confident if we had complete access to all the records, it would be over $1 billion. And by the way, government keeps this public spending private by arguing that it's proprietary business information, and we can't tell you how we're spending your money. This goes on all across America, not just in sports stadiums, but in all sorts of subsidies to business.
And how is this going to benefit the people in Queens? I mean, does this provide jobs? Is this going to mean that people are going to be able to get free or cheap seats at Yankee Stadium? I mean, is there going to be a benefit to people?
No, it's the exact reverse. First of all, the real reason they wanted a new stadium was to have more luxury boxes because those bring in real serious revenue. They're going to have, I think it's almost three times as many luxury boxes. And those luxury boxes that you paid for as a taxpayer and where the people who are in those boxes pay for them with tax-deductible dollars because businesses generally own them, whereas when you go to the game, you have to pay taxes and then buy your ticket out of your after-tax money. That's a personal expenditure. Well, they have their own separate hallways and entranceways so that literally you are being taxed so that the rich don't have to mingle with the likes of you and me. I mean, evidently we smell bad or something. The number of jobs will not increase. The number of seats is being reduced. Experience shows that when a new stadium is built in baseball, on average, ticket prices go up 41%. So subsidies don't produce lower prices. They produce higher prices. And this kind of perversion of economics is the reason, I argue, not the only reason, but a major reason, that the super wealthy's incomes are exploding and the bottom 90% of Americans' average income is lower than it was in 1973 when you adjust for inflation. Now think about that. 35 years ago, the bottom 90% of Americans enjoyed bigger real incomes than they do today.
You talk about subsidies in so many different ways. There are myriad ingenious ways to create these. You know, a few years back, there was a whole issue of eminent domain, and I don't know whether land was taken through that for the Yankee Stadium, but you also talk about a case of Kim Blankenship. Tell us about her case. Tell us about the case that she brought to the Supreme Court and how this illustrates some of the things you're talking about here.
Well, Kim Blankenship was a young mother in Toledo, Ohio. She and her husband, Herman, decided they didn't like working for other people, so they took a little building she owned, and they turned it into a garage. And they got a reputation for good, honest work, and their business flourished, and pretty soon they had about six or seven employees on the payroll. And then one day, the city of Toledo, Ohio, announced that it was going to try and persuade Chrysler to rebuild the oldest automobile factory in America, the one that built Jeeps. And to do this, they were going to use the city's power of eminent domain to seize property, including her home, her business, and a number of homes. They first went to the homes of people who were not particularly well-educated and were the sons of, and daughters of immigrants who had heard stories from the old country about the government just coming at gunpoint and saying, get out. And they got these people to sell out for a fraction of the value of their homes. Nice, neat little homes, the kind, you know, kept by people whose kitchen floors are so clean you could probably eat breakfast off them. Once they had acquired half the homes, they declared the area blighted. That meant that the property is worth a lot less, and then they went to the smarter people like Kim Blankenship and offered them a tiny fraction of the real value of their property. Well, Kim Blankenship looked at this and suddenly realized that they were also going to give, by the way, all sorts of state and local tax money, about $1 billion, to Chrysler. And she realized, my goodness, if the city can tax me to subsidize Chrysler, it could tax me to subsidize a competing garage down the street. So they got a lawyer, and they filed their court case, and they were opposed by every major business lobby, and I think 34 of the states and a couple of county governments also fought them. They got to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court wouldn't hear their case. It said, you have no standing to complain. You have no authority to bring a lawsuit challenging what's happening here. And so Chrysler went ahead with this, and by the way, what did Kim Blankenship and her husband lose their property for? For a gleaming new factory that would create well-paying jobs? Nah, they lost it to the lawn for the factory. Now, the really outrageous use of eminent domain, I think, is George W. Bush. George W. Bush, and everything I'm about to tell you, the White House does not disagree with a single fact I'm about to tell you, okay? George W. Bush made his fortune off a tax increase that was funneled into his pocket and the use of eminent domain to forcibly remove people from land that he coveted, but he was not willing to pay the market price for. This was the deal for the Texas Rangers baseball stadium. And every penny of profit in that deal came from the taxpayer subsidy. And I can't think of, you know, what better evidence of hypocrisy than you run saying, I want to cut taxes and I want you to have more of your money, when you made your fortune by forcing people to pay a tax that you put into your pocket. And yet, one thing I can tell you from hundreds of lectures I've given across the country is almost nobody knows this.
That's journalist David K. Johnston. Johnston's latest book is Free Lunch.
There's also been a lot of talk of earmarks. This is something both the Republicans and the Democrats have played to the hilt, and also during the election campaign they've talked as if they're against earmarks. Tell us about how earmarks are used. There was a lot of talk about Sarah Palin, who said she was against earmarks, but it seems like she was for them before she was against them.
We've always had earmarks. And per se, there's nothing wrong with individual members of Congress arranging to get some special funding for some project in their district. The problem is that they have gotten completely out of control. My colleague Diana Henriquez, when I worked at the New York Times, and Aaron Pilhofer did this astonishing story a few years ago on, you know, there's this constant talk about the war on Christians and how Christians are being persecuted, et cetera. It turns out that these earmarks, many of them are for Christian groups. They've been given billions of dollars, some of them tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money through these earmarks. And in Sarah Palin's case, she was fighting left and right for the Bridge to Nowhere until it became completely and totally politically unpalatable and was already effectively dead, and then she said she was against it. Well, that's in line with, you know, everybody says, we're against earmarks, and then they go and vote for them. This is entirely a bipartisan problem, and all the subsidies to business are bipartisan problems. The Democrats are in this up to their eyeballs as big as the Republicans are. And here's a little known fact that I broke originally in the New York Times and is in Free Lunch. Bill Clinton signed a law in 1997 that gave the 1,000 richest men, women, and children in America a tax cut larger than all the Bush tax cuts combined for that group of people. In fact, 60% larger.
How was
that? He cut their taxes 8 percentage points, and all the Bush tax cuts for this top group only amount to another 5 percentage points. By the way, did you get a 13 percentage point cut in your tax rate? No. So the problem here, it's important to understand, is that we have a government that relies on a very narrow base of political donors. I call them the political donor class. The number of paid lobbyists in Washington has more than doubled since the year 2000. Now think about that. Every day you read in the newspaper, somebody's laying off workers. Hewlett-Packard just announced 25,000 workers are going to lose their jobs. The drug company, Pfizer, got this huge tax break passed by Congress that was worth billions of dollars to them to create jobs. And what did they do? They cut their payroll by, I think it was about 20,000 people in the U.S. There is a narrow group of businesses who recognize that they really earn their profits by mining the public treasury. They are the ones who finance the campaigns. And this is the exact opposite of what Ronald Reagan said. Ronald Reagan used to go around in 1980 saying that the public will always vote for whoever offers them the biggest largesse from the public treasury, and this will ultimately lead to a dictatorship. Well, he was right, except for one thing. He would never have been elected if his quote was true, and it isn't the rabble, as he said, who are trying to vote themselves the largesse of the treasury. It's the elites who are doing it. It is the people with lobbyists who are voting themselves the public treasury and impoverishing everyone.
You also talk about executive pay.
Yes.
You talk about how, I mean, a lot of us know that executive pay is way out of line with what the rest of us make, you know, by multiple of hundreds of times that. Even in this market meltdown, the folks who brought us the market failure are walking away with huge executive pay bonuses. But you also say that this is actually written into tax and accounting loopholes, into actual public policy. How does that work?
Well, back in 1996, the New York Times did the biggest enterprise project in its history, and I was the lead reporter on it. And one of the key things we did is we changed the way executive compensation is reported on in this country and showed that there were huge hidden facets to executive compensation. We showed in particular how the then chairman of the Coca-Cola company had put together a billion-dollar fortune without paying a penny in taxes. Instead, Congress allows the company to pay the taxes on behalf of these executives. And that means that when you pay an executive let's say you're paying $105 million for the year, you take $5 million of it in cash, pay your taxes, you got $3 million left to live on, plus, of course, your fabulous executive expense account. And then you leave the other $100 million with the company. Now, you and I are only allowed to save $15,500 without paying taxes, or if we're over age 50, $20,500. But executives are allowed to save unlimited amounts of money. Well, if the company has to pay the taxes on that money, that costs them $35 million. So paying somebody $105 million costs the company $140 million. Well, when the CEO does this, and the CFO, and the CTO, and the CLO, and all the other senior executives, and a lot of the mid-level executives do this in descending amounts of money, the company suddenly owes so much money in taxes that it destroys the personnel budget. So the company goes to the rank-and-file workers without telling them what's going on and says, gee, guys, because of competition and how difficult it is to make a buck these days, we can't afford your pension plan anymore, or we can't afford your 401k match anymore, or we're going to have to cut your health care plan, and you're going to have to pay for more of it. You're not competing with other companies here. You're competing with the guys in the executive office. And tax policy allows and encourages this. It allows executives to set aside unlimited amounts of money for as long as they choose, right up till the day they die, if they choose. It allows them to pay no taxes on the money till they collect it, and if they manage to put it into an insurance policy, because they don't need the money and they want to pass it on to their heirs, they never pay taxes on that money. And yet you and I have these severe limitations placed on us, and by the way, companies have also been going and saying, we can't afford to fully fund our pensions, but let us make it up in the future. And then, of course, the future doesn't work out, and as we see, many, many people are not collecting their full pensions. They were cheated out of their money legally by the system. The real outrage here, though, is there's a complete separation of performance. Let me use John Snow as an example. John Snow ran the CSX Railroad before he was Treasury Secretary of the United States. As the stock of the company fell, his salary rose, and it rose enormously. I think he got $69 million, and he got a 69% increase in his pay as the stock fell about two-thirds. Exact opposite numbers. He walked away with an enormous fortune. Memory tells me it was about $200 million. He only worked the company for 25 years, but he got a pension for 44 years, and he got paid out in cash. And this is all the result of tax policy that allows this. By the way, after he was Treasury Secretary of the United States, Mr. Snow, who was one of the biggest proponents of free marketeerism, became head of a company called Cerebus, and it owns a company you probably never heard of but you know about from the news called IAP Worldwide. You remember all those trucks full of ice that never got to New Orleans but sat in places like Chattanooga and Atlanta idling?
You bet.
IAP Worldwide. You remember the mold and the awful repair job done on the quarters for wounded soldiers and their families at Walter Reed Army Hospital? IAP Worldwide. The very people who are at the top of our government promoting to us these policies of free market, get government out of the way, no regulation, are in fact the people who are profiteering off of this. The President of the United States, Dick Cheney, who set up dozens if not hundreds of offshore entities so that Halliburton could avoid paying taxes, and then they got huge no-bid contracts for their KBR subsidiary in the war, Treasury Secretary John Snow, and others. I mean, this is it's just incredible to me that the American public is not revulsed by these scandals.
And now a new scandal may be looming. By the time we air this, we'll already know how that has come out in terms of this bailout of Wall Street, whether they're actually going to hold these guys' feet to the fire or they're just going to give them whatever they want on a silver platter. If you were in the position of the Treasury Secretary, if you could set a policy, what are some of the key things that you would do right now?
Well, the first and principal problem is that there is an economic fire going on here, and you've got to contain the conflagration. I mean, all bad policies aside, you really don't want to plunge the country and the world into a depression. That's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I guess, to use a different metaphor. So you need to restore some sense of confidence in the markets. But number one, we need to regulate banks. And you notice Goldman Sachs has announced today, along with Morgan Stanley, that they're going to convert into bank holding companies, which will make them subject to regulation by the federal government. Of course, if we don't hire enough bank examiners and regulators and tell them to go do their jobs, it's a hollow reform. And one of the things we know about this particular administration is that they have done all sorts of things to avoid real investigations. For example, the Inspector General of the Military said he was doing nothing to look into the disappearance of the $12 billion of cash that was shipped in, I think it took four plane loads, big, huge military airlift plane loads, to carry this cash to Iraq, because the special inspector general was doing it. And then we find out from Charlie Savage, then of the Boston Globe, now at the New York Times, that President Bush issued a signing order that basically said the inspector general is not going to really investigate this stuff. So we have a non-investigation into the disappearance of this enormous hoard of cash. So you have to have real regulation. You have to have real regulators who can do their job. You have to have a real staff who can do their job. On the tax side of this, by the way, you know, the country is much larger and more complicated than it was 20 years ago, but the number of IRS auditors is down by a third, and the very best auditors, the really competent ones, have been driven out of the business. The IRS's request for $12 million more, they were spending $24 million, they wanted to go to $36 million, to pursue Osama bin Laden's money in 2003. Was denied by the White House on the grounds that it was too expensive to the American taxpayer. We couldn't afford it. I kid you not. There's a government document I cite in the story I wrote about this in the New York Times on, I think it was March 31 of 2003 or 2004.
Now, in terms of what your book says, Free Lunch, and we're talking with David K. Johnston, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, formerly of the New York Times. His book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Going forward, what might be, if you had one recommendation to make that might begin to turn the pendulum the other way, to begin to redress this grievous situation, what would it be?
Are you talking about Wall Street here?
Wall Street, more particularly, and more generally, actually, this whole situation of corporate socialism, how to make the system fairer for American citizens in general, for the bulk of us?
Well, changes like this occur because there are broad cultural changes in the marketplace. You know, Ronald Reagan started it was starting a little bit before him, but he got the ball really going with his assertions that, you know, big government was the problem, et cetera. And so the fundamental thing we have to do is get people informed so that we can change the culture. And here are two fundamental ways to do that. I think people ought to be asking this question every time they read about a tax forgiveness or a subsidy or some benefit to some company for a new investment they're going to make. If it's a sound investment, the market will make it. If it's not a sound investment, why should the state's coercive power to force you to pay taxes at the barrel of a gun be used to make you subsidize an unsound investment? So that's the first one. If it's a sound investment, the market will make it. If it's not a sound investment, why should you be forced into subsidizing that investment? The second one is, we need to stop discussing taxes only in terms of the share of income taxes paid by the wealthiest Americans. We need to look at the total burden of taxes. It turns out that, for example, in New York State, thought of by many people as one of the more progressive states, that the wealthy pay a smaller share of their income to the state than the poor. In Alabama, the wealthiest citizens pay less than half as much of their income to the state as the poor. And we need to fundamentally address this issue and get off this notion that taxes are a way of punishing productive people. Taxes have a moral basis. It's come down to us for 2,500 years from the Athenians. It is the oldest and most conservative principle in Western civilization, and that is you cannot become wealthy without the existence of a civilization, and the wealthier you manage to become, the greater your moral duty to maintain that civilization that made your wealth possible. That's the moral principle that gave birth to democracy, and to the extent that we are ignoring that, and we're instead giving unlimited, unreviewable power to the government to spend our tax dollars, that we are taxing the poor and the middle class to literally give money to the richest people in America, we are giving up democracy.
Well, David K. Johnston, it's been a pleasure talking with you about your book, Free Lunch, and about the situation that is right now going on that is such a prime example of the things you talk about in your book.
Thank you, Francesca.
David K. Johnston. In addition to Free Lunch, he's also the author of Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else. The announcement. On Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m., Elizabeth Winthrop will give a lecture and presentation on her award-winning novel, Counting on Grace. It's the story of a young girl working in a textile mill in Vermont in 1910. For more information, call 413-322-5660. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Tune in next week when Francesca talks with another Pulitzer Prize winner, Ron Suskind, about his best-selling new book, The Way of the World. To hear the whole hour of Writer's Voice, go to writersvoice.net. Francesca talks with novelist Francine Prose about her new novel, Golden Grove, in the second half of that show. It'll be posted on Monday. Thanks for listening. I'm Michael Pollitt.